Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, the countdown is on for tonight's Olympic opening ceremony. The event gets underway in just 4 hours' time, marking the official start of the London 2012 Games. These people can't wait.
It's all about this, you know what I'm trying to say. We might as well enjoy it while it's here.
We can't wait. We're really up for it. It's going to be the best Games ever.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. You look around and you think, you know, finally something like this has brought, you know, brought us together and got such an amazing place.
Danny Boyle is the man behind tonight's ceremony at the Olympic Stadium, which promises to be a spectacular event.
This is a live performance, and it's the actors, and in our case they are volunteers, and who have to get up there and do it. So any kind of nervousness I feel for them, it's for them really, because my nerves are not important.
Meanwhile, the Olympic torch has now completed its 70-day, 8,000-mile journey around the UK. The chairman of the Games Organising Committee, Lord Sevco, says this is the culmination of years of hard work.
It's just an extraordinary day for me. I mean, this has been actually slightly more than seven because, of course, we were bidding and, you know, when the torch is on its final journey, that's a massive, massive moment in the life of any Olympic history.
There is a lot of secrecy surrounding tonight, with very few details being released, including who will light the Olympic cauldron. What we do know, though, is that Sir Chris Hoy will carry the flag for Team GB. Kate Howie did the same job in Athens in 2004. She's the coach of the British women's judo team this time round and says Sir Chris will enjoy the whole occasion.
In terms of how it feels, it's absolutely amazing. And just thinking about what Chris will be feeling like going into there, I'm not sure what will be going through his head, because to carry a flag, your home country flag, in your country at your home games, it's unbelievable.
The Olympic Stadium is expected to be a sellout tonight, with an estimated audience of 1 billion people worldwide watching the event on TV. Earlier, bells will rung for 3 minutes to mark the Games. That's the latest. I'm Jenny Lyne.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Westbury on Trim and the head of the finance portfolio for the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council. That's Jeff Gollop. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour after six, 30 years ago, a young woman was stopped at the customs hall of Rome Airport. While the customs officers were searching her suitcase, they discovered some documents inside a false lining. As they read through them, their eyes widened. This was the proof of what Italians had long suspected. Plans of the Grand Orient Order of Italy to take over newspapers and political parties in what they called the Plan to Renew Democracy. It was, of course, nothing of the sort, but a programme to destroy the rising Communist Party, which was being democratically elected, and reintroduce a Mussolini-style rule by fear. The Masons had been running an invisible parallel government of traitors in Italy and would use their own secret services, military intelligence, to kidnap and kill their political rivals, kill some of their own people, and fit up for these high-level political assassinations domestic left-wing radicals and the Russians. Plus, on a lighter note, will there be a bomb at the Olympics? The army have made that less likely than G4S shambles, but nevertheless, if the unthinkable does happen, who might benefit? And when the mainstream media tell us who it was, how can we tell who really did it? Plus, the Washington Post says the Free Syrian Army is creeping back and forth across the border and using NATO's Turkey as a base. Syrian rebels have also been coming to the Turkish border to get bigger and better weapons. So the conflict's looking less and less like a genuine uprising. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, what a lovely week we've had, but I'm afraid the temperatures are falling. Lows of 13 Celsius tonight and dry. Highs only up to 20 Celsius this weekend. Sunny on Saturday, a bit of light rain on Sunday. Next week, highs of 20 Celsius, some sunny spells, but plenty of showers this week. It won't be so hot and balmy over the next 7 days. Next weekend, that's the 4th and 5th of August, highs of 16 Celsius, sunny spells and showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest now, and I'm joined by Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim, Jeff Gollop. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Hi.
First of all, I'm going to go straight to some guests we had last week. They're from Bristol Remploy, who employ people who are disabled, and they've been going since the Second World War. They were set up by your very own Winston Churchill after World War II to employ people who'd been injured during the war and make sure they had a job. And it looks like that their future is hanging in the balance, even though the unit we have here in Bristol, which is part of a larger group across the country, is making money. How can we justify putting disabled people on the dole? If we do, of course, the public's going to have to pay far more for them than they are at the moment. And at the moment, in Bristol here, apparently they're paying nothing because they're making money.
Well, it doesn't make sense. It's one of the things that gives organisations and management a bad name when decisions like this are made and there is no necessary rhyme or reason to it happening. One of the big concerns I have on so many issues is exactly the point you make, that if those people are put on onto benefits, that will simply cost the taxpayer significantly more than it's costing to employ them at the moment. I just desperately call for common sense in a situation like this.
Now, their employees, something like 20, 25 of them full-time, are being told, it looks like you may be saved, but we can't tell you who has made a bid for it. Do you think that's acceptable?
I don't think that's acceptable for any employees, but certainly not for those who have gone through the unsettling times that these particular disabled people have been through. No, it ought to be possible to give a clear answer, and I can't see any reason why they shouldn't be told.
Okay, so if you have a message for the relevant minister, who of course is a fellow Conservative, what would that be?
The message would be to be open and I think to consider the effect on the lives of the people who are affected and actually give them a solution as quickly as possible.
But the message coming down from this government is that doesn't matter a fig. What matters is the bottom line money from my department. We're having to cut our budget. This is a part of my budget. It's not a part of the DSS budget or Social Security budget, and so I'm going to cut it.
Well, one of the things I think is important is joined up thinking, and the fact is that if one ends up with a cost to one or a saving to one department that produces a bigger cost to a number of other departments than the local authority, that actually central government is losing out and the taxpayer is losing out. And so that's what I'd be calling for, is actually talking with those involved to try and resolve it in a satisfactory way that causes the minimum amount of grief to those involved.
Okay, we've also had last week on here the Marvin Rees, the Labour candidate for mayor. How's the Conservative Party locally pursuing, getting on with choosing a mayor, and what's the process? When are we likely to hear?
Right. The party went through the process last week of going through all the applicants that had put their names forward. It identified three of those applicants to be put forward to the shortlist. I'm pleased to say that I'm one of those. And party
can you tell us who the other two are then?
It is in the public domain. Councillor Peter Abraham and former Councillor Barbara Lewis. And the three of us will present to members of the party on the 7th of August, when the decision will be taken.
Okay, and what do you think is the sort of quality that you will be able to bring if you do this? I mean, what's your vision, Jeff, for the city into the future? And particularly, you know, if you actually do get the candidacy and get the job, you know, what are you going to bring to the city?
Well, the first thing I think is that Bristol is the most fantastic city that has undersold itself and hasn't quite believed in itself as much as it should have done over the years. And I believe the most important role for the elected mayor of whatever party is to actually be a leader, a focus for the strength of the city, so that we can actually achieve what the city is capable of. So that I see as the most important thing. But I have a very real concern over the years that a large number of decisions in Bristol are being made on purely political bases, and sometimes political bases that it's very hard to fully understand where those decisions are coming from. And I actually believe there needs to be a massive amount of common sense. I think there also needs to be some very serious financial management in the way the city moves. It has a £1 billion budget, and I believe it needs to be that needs to be managed to produce more effective spending as well. So I actually see leadership, I see financial decision, and I see then key policy issues such as education and transport, which are areas where the council needs to be making some very, very strong decisions quickly rather than delaying decision making, which we've become extremely good at over the years.
But I mean, whoever becomes mayor, aren't they going to be banging their head against a brick wall, as we've just heard with the Remploy story? Actually, these big decisions are made in Westminster, and you just simply have to take them on the chin.
There's always scope to argue, there's always scope to put a case. The city deal, which actually sees more powers and more authority and more finance delegated to cities like Bristol, is going to give a real opportunity to start to shape the way the city moves forward. At the end of the day, what we need most of all in Bristol is creating jobs, because it's actually only new jobs created in the private sector that is actually going to create the wealth to provide what all the citizens of Bristol need and deserve. So bringing business into the city, making it work, making sure that it creates the opportunity for our youngsters, for the unemployed, and indeed for those who are disabled in some form, is ultimately the only way we're going to achieve.
But the fact is, Jeff, that the wealth is going in the opposite direction. People are taking their wealth out of the city, whether that's squirreling it away in tax havens, or else whether they're offshoring, which is employing people in India and Malaysia and China to do work because they will do it over there cheaper.
Well, that's true, but on the other hand, you only need to look at the Trunkie story, for example, where having developed and manufactured in China, the company is now looking at bringing manufacturing for part of its products back into the UK. So actually, there are stories coming the other way, and Bristol has a very good record of attracting business over the last 10 years of pretty poor economic conditions. And what we've got to do is actually achieve even more. And that's going to be possible. The way the government is setting up the non-business rate, growth in business rate over the next 7 years will actually belong to the local authorities and be available for reinvestment in infrastructure and so on. So there's some real incentive to bring businesses to the greater Bristol area, and that's what we need. There's some fantastic success stories around, and we need to build on those.
Well, one thing that's definitely not stopping new businesses starting in Bristol is empty office space, because we've got, as we heard last week, something like 75 million square feet of empty office space in Bristol, which is the equivalent of several tens of thousands of homes if it was to be translated into the floor space of housing. But the trouble is, this isn't being used because the rents are so high. I mean, you're imagine into the free market. Why is it that and how is it that these companies that own these massive buildings don't just keep dropping the rent until someone actually moves in and starts using that office? How come we've got these 70 so-called million square feet of empty office space?
I'll have a go along with Martin here at explaining most economics, but I have to say the economic model of office construction in the city is something that is beyond comprehension.
I'm glad to hear it's a mystery to you as well.
I don't understand it. We have office blocks that are designed as corporate headquarters for large businesses, and they're sat there and they're empty. And they're not actually the right sort of office space that small developing businesses would want to go into and certainly could afford to go into.
I'm sure they could quite easily be converted to sort of open plan offices, hot desking types situations. Martin, can you throw some light on this? How come we've got these 75 million square feet of empty offices? Because it sounds like we've got the opportunity for exactly what Jeff wants there, massive amount of new jobs in the city.
Well, there are two main reasons why you've got this oversupply of office space. One is partly to do with the way the property market works in Britain. I mean, basically, these things are assets, and they're counted as assets on your balance sheet. So whether you're using them or not, they're worth something, and that's, basically you're speculating on property bubbles. And even when the bubble bursts, you don't want to let it go necessarily because you're hoping
now
it might restart.
Hold it there, because something's just occurred to me. If that is an asset on your balance sheet, and you start renting it out for less than the market rent, then that asset is going to fall on your balance sheet, isn't it? And, well, and yes. Maybe that's what businesses don't want to see.
Yeah, and also, of course, you see some people own very old properties in Bristol, like the Red Factory in Portman Square near where you live, and it's a listed building, so the people who own it can't do it up and do anything with it, and they can't knock it down either. So it
well, actually,
sits
they
there.
Do have planning permission too.
Well, they may be, yeah. They may be trying to do something about it. They have.
I think the main problem there is that they're not finding it's possible to borrow the money to do the development.
And then on the back of that, you've then got the planning law is very weak, so people think that the council can say we don't want this, we don't want that. In actual fact, that's not the case, as Jeff will know. It's quite difficult to block a decision that a developer takes. And if you challenge it, they can challenge you, and you can end up losing money challenging them in the appeal, and then lose when you get to the appeal, because it's all rigged in their favour. And of course, many people in the city think the council can decide what goes up and what goes on, but of course it can't. And the other thing, of course, is the business rate. If you should be charged full rate if you're not using the building, and they'd soon find some use for it then. So you could fiddle with the tax regime to try and push them along. But I mean, basically, it says everything that's wrong with the way the British economy is managed, doesn't it? 75,000, was it million square feet of office space?
75 million square feet. Yeah.
I mean, the Japanese would just laugh at that.
Yeah, I know. It's, right. So at least, I mean, let's look on the positive side. At least we've got the office space for all these new jobs. Even if we haven't got the money, the banks aren't lending the money in order to get them going, Jeff. Overall, then, what do you see as the most important ingredient in actually getting these jobs going? Because I mean, I think we all want to see jobs. Everybody wants to see people off the dole. The whole idea of full employment seemed to go out with Harold Wilson, sort of 30, 40 years ago. I have heard hardly any serious politicians saying we're going to get full employment and this is how we're going to do it. So how are we going to get that in Bristol?
Well, I see one of the main issues is transport, because in the areas of highest employment, it's often very difficult for people to get out of their community to where the jobs are. So we have to ensure that there is proper transport provision to make it possible for people to actually get to work. And so that is one issue. The other issue, which is going to take longer, but is actually education, where we have to be ensuring that we are producing people who have the ability to deliver the jobs that are required of them. And that is something where we've got to be pushing the youngsters who currently can't get work. We've got to be making sure that there is every opportunity for them to get the qualifications they need to make them employable.
Well, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, you must be have seen this news this week. GDP is down 0.7%. There's now talk not just of a double dip recession, but of a slump. Tell us what GDP is, Martin.
Well, GDP stands for Gross Domestic Product. And it's a raw figure. Gross national product involves, I think, the calculation of net property income from abroad. So GDP is a more, it's a more raw figure. And it basically can be measured in two ways. It's what everybody's spent in the economy in a year, or what everybody's earned. And of course, the two figures are supposed to add up, but they don't add up because of the black economy. And you can estimate the size of the black economy by looking at the difference between what people have spent and what they claim to have earned.
But it's down 0.7%. It doesn't sound
well. This
good.
Is a raw figure again. It may be not as bad, or it may be worse. But this is it will be modified further down the line. It is quite bad, though, obviously.
Okay, let's have a listen now to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, with his reaction to this announcement from the Office of Budget Responsibility that the economy, that is to say our GDP, has gone down 7%.
Well, we know the economy has deep-rooted problems, and today's disappointing figures are further confirmation of that. We've got to deal with the debts we built up in this country over many years. We've also got the debt crisis abroad. And I think the government has to have a relentless focus on the economy. And the announcements we've been making on infrastructure, on getting lending to businesses, show we have that relentless focus. Of course, there are one-off factors like the bank holiday, but that's not an excuse that I'm using. Frankly, even without that, these would be disappointing numbers. And I think they just remind us that Britain has some deep-rooted economic problems that are going to take time to solve. We've also got the debt crisis abroad. And all of these things, of course, make it a big challenge for our country. But we've got to have that relentless focus on the economy. We've got to make sure we're getting the lending to businesses, that we're investing in the future, investing in infrastructure. And you'll have seen that's precisely what the government is doing.
Well, you can't see him, but I could when I was recording that, because it was actually on the TV. Even when he finished it, he didn't really look that confident, Jeff, that he was delivering. I mean, he's talking there about lending to business still, and we know that's just simply not happening.
It is happening, but it's not happening enough. But I think one of the difficulties there is a lot of owner-managed businesses are actually choosing at the moment to be repaying debt anyway rather than borrowing, because of their concerns about the direction of the economy. And that, therefore, is one of the contributory factors. But, you know, the other thing I think that we've got to look at in all this and keep in perspective, if we're in Spain at the moment, the government would be paying 7.6% to borrow the national debt. What's happened here is by reducing public spending, we are applying that money to reducing the borrowing. So what we have to recognise is that had we not taken the steps we had, we would be in a situation now where we'd be paying significantly more money to borrow the debt that we've got.
But we heard a few months ago our total debt has now reached $1 trillion, so the actual total amount is going up. I mean, all you're saying there really effectively is that, well, it may be bad here, but it's not quite as bad as Spain.
It's nowhere near as bad as Spain, but the fact is that if we don't show signs of coming out of the economic slowdown relatively quickly, then I think there will be increased pressure for public spending to be directed at further infrastructure projects to actually achieve bringing back growth and confidence, and it's a very delicate one to get that balance right. But I would suspect that those thoughts were now being considered by the Treasury as is the direction to go.
Well, I mean, we heard George Osborne there. You could hear the building site in the background, scaffolding. I mean, wherever I see him in one of those high-vis jackets, he looks to me like the guy who's a demolition man. Are you convinced he knows what he's doing?
I'm confident that the direction he's taking the economy is the only way that we can go at the moment. What's slightly baffling and surprising about this fall in GDP is that it comes at a time when the number of people in employment is actually growing. And I wonder about the accuracy of figures. I have clients turning over relatively very modest sums of money, the odd couple of hundred thousand pounds, who can take 3 to 6 months to get their accounts out after the end of the year. I really wonder how we can be coming up with estimates of GDP within 23 days of the end of a quarter. And so I think there's got to be a question about the pressure for economic statistics being so great that they're being accelerated forward before actually the full measurement is in place, because there's got to be one set of figures that's wrong. Either the employment figures is wrong or the growth figures are inconsistent. And I think we need proper detailed analysis of that. If the information's wrong, people are making decisions on the economy without being in full possession of the facts.
But this is the Independent Office of Budget Responsibility, so their word is law. Anyway, before we hear from Martin Summers, let's hear from George Osborne's boss, David Cameron, to see what he said about these figures this week.
Cameron pledged to do more for the economy.
My message today is clear and unequivocal. Be in no doubt, we will go on and finish the job. We will deal with the deficit, we will keep UK interest rates low, and we will continue to take the tough decisions that are necessary for business leaders and investors to have confidence in the long-term future of the British economy.
Well, what we're hearing from David Cameron there is what you'd expect to hear. He's talking Britain up. That's his job as Prime Minister. I was interested to hear what Jeff said earlier about the possibility of increasing spending on infrastructure as a possibility in these circumstances. I think we're now moving into the realm where we can have a serious public debate about what the way forward is without being dug into trenches about it. And I think that's what the nation needs. I mean, the Labour front bench have been saying you're going too far too fast, and of course they will feel vindicated by these figures. And as you say, there is a disjunction between the measured unemployment figures and the measured GDP figures, but that's partly because the unemployment figures, the actual number of people claiming unemployment benefit, went up slightly by about 6,000, but the figure they're quoting is the Labour force survey figure, which goes out and asks people, have you looked for work in the last 3 weeks and are you working? Now, of course, lots of people have been discouraged and not in the labour force survey or claiming benefits. There's lots of people out there who would like to work, but they can't claim benefits, so they don't appear in the figures. Now, in other words, it's lies, damned lies and statistics. Mm-hmm. And as you rightly say, if you don't take all the statistics with a pinch of salt and really understand what they're showing, you can make the wrong decisions, even if you've got the right ideas. But what I fear is that this is just the beginning, because we're about to, I think we're about to see, under the Leap 2020, the French think tank that I mostly rate, they are saying there will probably be a banking collapse in the autumn. And Britain, of course, as the centre of world banking, or one of the centres of world banking, will be at ground zero. And I think we're going to be talking very differently about all these things in 6 months' time. And not in a pleasant way.
There's another story we have this week, in fact, Martin, which you've hinted at there, which is the Eurozone crisis risk map. Extremely opposed. UK has more to lose than any other nation. Now, Jeff, this bothers me, this one. This is Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic are also vulnerable. But this was in the Daily Mail this week, that the UK has more to lose than any other nation. Now, I thought, because we weren't in the Eurozone, we would be insulated from all this. But it seems that our financial institutions are massively vulnerable to a collapse in the euro. And it could have, in fact, at least as big, if not a bigger effect in Britain if the euro collapses than in other European countries.
Well, I have to say, I'm sitting here almost speechless, because I've never been in a situation where I've been in an interview where an interviewer has quoted the Daily Mail at me as a source of learned information.
Well, we do it quite a lot on here, actually.
He's a big Daily Mail fan.
Well, I mean, you know, I like to take a little bit from, you know, everybody. A bit of Morningstar and a bit of Daily Mail, that's me.
Well, it's good to have a good variety. I've tried to read around the Eurozone, and it may be Martin can enlighten me later with his knowledge, but I see an awful lot of experts out there who actually have no idea of how it's going to resolve itself and how it's going to unravel. And the fact is that if there is a major banking crisis and a euro crisis, our economy is so interlinked with the European economies by nature of trade that we are going to be suffering as much as the next man. I think it is impossible to predict which countries will suffer most, because no one knows exactly how any crisis will happen. And no one actually knows which country is going to trigger that crisis and what the domino effect.
Well, this is a report that's been put together by risk analysis consultancy Maplecroft. UK, they say, is one of only 18 nations rated extremely vulnerable in the 169 nation Eurozone exposure index, which they've spent a little bit of time and trouble figuring out who actually holds this euro debt. So if someone says at some point, no, none of this debt is going to be paid back, Britain is going to be one of the major investors, if you want, who's going to have their debt's being defaulted.
I mean, it's inevitable that Britain is going to suffer, because we are a financial services centre and we are exposed to what is going on in the Eurozone. But the fact is that by remaining out of the euro, we have an economy that will be able to continue to operate whilst the euro has to, economies have to find alternative means of operating if that comes about.
Martin, what's going to happen if there is this? I mean, we're constantly hearing, it's almost like you've heard it so many times, you've almost forgotten about it, that there's this euro crisis. But if it does hit, what's it going to look like over here in Britain? And I suppose the most important question is the Treasury ready to step in? Because that's what we expect from our government, is to step in a situation where the market's failed.
Well, I think it's a very extreme situation, as Jeff has outlined. It's not just that we'll lose because we'll lose exports. It's also an immediate hit because of the financial linkages. Mm-hmm. And I think that people think of this as a euro crisis, but it's actually a crisis of the international banking system with the euro as the focus. And I think that there is ultimately going to be a crash here. The von Mises Institute, who are a right-wing, free-market, von Hayekian outfit, they see it the same way I do, is that ultimately the market solution for debt is a crash. And, of course, that's what they don't tell you when you set off to have your bubble, that at the end of it there's going to be a crash. Because at the top of every bubble, every time, we get told that we've now reached the Goldilocks economy, end to boom and bust, and we all know who said that. And, of course, that is not the nature of a dynamic capitalist economy. It has booms and it has busts. And booms like the one we've just had, which have been sustained by central banks just basically giving money away and trying to keep it going, it's likely to end in very serious tears.
But, Jeff, I mean, a lot of these financial institutions are quite linked to the present cabinet, the present Conservative cabinet. I mean, we've heard about Lord Green last week, who was the chairman of HSBC when there was all this money laundering going on. And yet he still feels confident enough to stay around the cabinet table. Are you confident to have somebody who has been in charge of a big bank like HSBC when they have been shown now to have been laundering trillions of pounds for these Mexican drug cartels? I was just flicking through to find out what these cartels have been up to. I mean, we're talking about dumping of bodies of murder victims during rush hour in Mexico. A couple of weeks later, another 32 more corpses are found nearby in three houses. This is how these drug cartels operate. And Lord Green, who's, you know, one of our cabinet ministers now, through the House of Lords, he's been made a peer, was in charge of HSBC at the time. Are you surprised that, you know, people are a bit cynical about government when somebody who seems to have been involved in that kind of financial crime, money laundering, is not prepared to resign when this is kind of thing is uncovered?
I think it's very difficult to make judgments on issues like this when I would not expect the person who's actually chairing an organisation like that to be fully to be aware of all the transactions that go on in the name of that organisation. So I wouldn't necessarily be concerned in that respect. I would be concerned that the controls were not in place within that bank to ensure that that didn't happen. And I'd see that as a major governance issue, and therefore I think it would be right to be questioning those directors responsible for governance as to why they let that happen. So that's a judgment issue about the management, but I wouldn't be challenging them on the specific individual issues.
Martin, did you see this article in the Guardian Observer last weekend? This is it's quite amazing. It's by Ed Valliemi, which is, I mean, he's one of their standard sort of economic analysts, really.
Yeah, and he's a sort of general reporter. He used to report from Bosnia.
And, well, he's done a lot of stuff on, you know, I suppose over the last 6 months on similar sorts of things. But his headline is "Global Banks Are the Financial Services Wing of the Drug Cartels." And as we know, these drug cartels are absolutely ruthless murderers.
Yeah, well, it's a fundamental problem. I mean, what I would say about Lord Green is this bank is too big if he doesn't know what's going on in his Mexican subsidiary. Yeah. And that's an issue. And don't forget, the British taxpayer is on the hook to bail out HSBC because it's based at headquarters here in Britain. But it's some, you know, what if they get fined a fortune in the US? We will ultimately end up having to back that up, because we are backing up the banking system. You know, the British taxpayer is backing up the British financial services industry. Now, that rings alarm bells to me, that these banks are too big to fail, too big to bail, and too big to jail.
But isn't it the same with corporations and with governments now? That everyone says when something goes horrendously wrong like this, I mean, it's quite clearly massive criminal activity going on within his bank while he was in charge, that he's not prepared to say, OK, I'm going to take
Lord
the rap.
Green,
it doesn't seem anybody's prepared to take the rap anymore.
No, that's true, and that's a wider issue. But the fact of the matter is, sadly, the UN report on drugs and crime, which came out in 2009, pointed out that virtually all the banks, as soon as they were in trouble, the drug cartels went to them and said, "Hey, you're having a panic, boys. Would you like some money? Because we've got some." And they went, "Yes, yes, yes." And it was all sucked in. So virtually all the dirty money all over the world was sucked into the banking system in one go, like a big sucking noise. So we've actually got an international financial system which is being propped up by drug cartels and the taxpayer. And that is our fundamental economic problem, not the euro. The euro is a symptom.
Yeah. Okay. But if you take it, and there may be a danger that Martin and I might end up agreeing on this, but if you look at the deregulation that's happened, I mean, I'm old enough to remember the days when if you went on holiday, you were only allowed to take £50 in sterling out of the country, and absolutely, you couldn't use a credit card abroad without it being approved, and every transaction was part of what you were allowed to spend. Once that got removed, the volume of transactions that go on are not being monitored or recorded. We are in the daft situation that more money is spent on gambling on exchange rates and stock markets than is actually dealt in shares.
Why are you a Conservative? Because that all happened under Margaret Thatcher and the Conservative government in the early 1980s.
The major deregulation happened under Tony Blair that actually allowed the expansion and allowed the banks total free rein.
I mean, surely it was Thatcher originally that knocked down exchange controls, which was the first basically saying, well, look, you can be British, you can support the British mm-hmm. Olympic team and the football team, but actually, in the financial world, anything goes. Money can go in and out of the country, be invested anywhere at all. There are no financial ring fence.
I believe in freedom of trade where it is trade. What I believe is wrong is that people are now making and breaking companies or economies by gambling on what's going to happen with share prices or exchange rates, and that is something that I believe is not intended in the free market. That is a manipulation. That's manipulating outcomes for the benefit of gamblers, and is actually leaving those who either ordinary investors or employed in jobs in those businesses potentially at risk as a result of it.
And in the same week, London Mayor Boris Johnson has admitted paying cash a lot after the minister says families who settle bills cash in hand are as bad as tax avoiders. Martin, this is interesting, isn't it, that we're now hearing that the people who are of tax evaders and tax avoiders are those who are taking cash in hand.
Well, I think it's right with people paying cash in hand are evading taxes or helping to evade taxes. But what it is trying to spread the blame and saying people's little tax avoidances are the same as the huge tax avoidances that Jeff and other manipulations that Jeff's just been alluding to. And I think basically the tax office doesn't care about small amounts of money. Chasing small amounts of money is a waste of time. And so that's why you have self-assessment in small business, because it's much easier just let. And of course they know when people are cheating, because they know what sort of turnover businesses have, and they say basically people at the margin at that level are not really the problem. The problem is these huge manipulations at the top level, mm-hmm. which as you quite rightly point out, you end up in a situation where you're not in a free market. What the free marketeers of the Von Mises Institute were saying when the banks started to wobble is let them go. But of course you are then possibly facing up to huge chunks of your economy going down with them, and at that point the government steps in. And that of course is the point, that the market is dependent upon society, not the other way around, and ultimately we are on the hook for the losses, but all the profits when things are going well going to private individuals, and basically Julian said the other week on this programme, businessman from Somerset, it's the age of the swindlers, and it started in the 80s and it was continued in the 90s. I think the political elite in this country as a whole have basically been far too close to the City of London for far too long, and we're now going to face the consequences.
Now, Jeff, Tory Minister David Gawk claimed paying people cash in hand was morally wrong. Would you agree with that?
I don't agree with that, because that is putting the blame on the person doing the paying, who is purely parting with their cash. But the blame should go with the businessman who is evading cash. And can I say, as a practicing accountant, I'd actually put it on the blame at their advisors as well. Because any client I deal with who might receive cash, I would ask if they receive cash. And I would make clear that I would expect to declare the cash that they receive. Now, I don't know for certain that every client of mine comes up and tells me that. But that's the moral obligation, and it is clear in my view, it's that businessman who is stealing from the rest of us. And that can't be condoned in any way. The customer, on the other hand, is only simply trying to get done the job they need doing. So I see the blame lays very much with the businessman. But I agree with Martin. The cash economy for the plumber and the jobbing builder, whilst it's important we get it right, is insignificant in the scheme of all the other things that are going on, where tax isn't necessarily being accounted for as it should be.
Absolutely right. And one of those, of course, is the report which came out last weekend in The Observer from the Tax Justice Campaign. We had John Christensen from there on here a few weeks ago. The super rich stash $21 trillion in offshore havens. Now, a trillion is a million. Billion is 1,000 million, is that right? And wealthy tax evaders, aided by private banks, have exploited loopholes in tax legislation and stashed over $21 trillion in offshore funds, says a report. The capital drain from some developing countries since 1970 would be enough to pay off national debts. The findings show the gap between the haves and the have-nots is much larger than previously thought. Now, we also had Kevin Carhill from The Rich List on here a few weeks ago, Jeff, who was saying that all they can really do with The Rich List is look at domestic wealth. So where people have squirreled it away in these places like the Cayman Islands, it's very difficult to actually identify how much money they've got. What are your thoughts about this then, comparing that to the last story about people paying in cash in hand?
Well, I'm not sophisticated enough to understand how these schemes work. But as far as I'm concerned, if someone's resident in this country, they should be paying tax in this country, and if they're resident in another country, they should be paying tax in that country. And I cannot begin to believe our tax system is such that we can allow people to build up. I presume that's worldwide, the offshore havens bit, but I cannot believe that we are allowing people to get away with it. And the government have promised a general anti-abuse legislation that will actually catch all. It's quite remarkable that it's taken so long for that.
But I mean, isn't the real problem, Jeff, here, that we have a cabinet of millionaires, many of whom have got their money squirreled away as part of this $21 trillion in the tax havens? I mean, we had David Cameron's father, apparently, was one of the pioneers of the use of tax havens and kept most of their family wealth in Panama and in the Cayman Islands. So can we really expect these turkeys to vote for Christmas to say, well, you know, let's have some new legislation to cut down on those wonderful tax havens that mean we don't have to pay any tax?
Well, I'm not privy to the tax arrangements of the cabinet, but I believe in equity. I believe that we should be ensuring that everybody is paying their fair amount of tax, and actually capturing the tax from those who currently are evading it is something that is very high on my list, and I genuinely believe on the government's list, because the fact is that the economic situation is such that we need to restore the financial certainty in the country as quickly as we can, and we are never going to do that if a very small proportion of people are actually taking a very large sum of money out of tax. But bear in mind the figures, and I haven't got them here, but Martin may know that the top 1% of the population pay, is it something like 25% of the income tax take?
I don't think I haven't got the figures to hand either.
It's a very high proportion, so I think we need to be careful that we don't presume that absolutely everyone is evading tax, but I do firmly believe that any tax evader is one too many, and we should be ensuring that is corrected
and quickly. The country needs those funds.
It certainly does. Martin, $21 trillion in offshore havens, according to Tax Justice Network. Absolutely astronomical figure. And I put to you what I put to Jeff. Can we expect this cabinet, many of whom are, I mean, we know it's a cabinet of millionaires, 23, when there may have been some changes since they first started, of course there have been, but 23 of the 29 original members of the cabinet were millionaires, and David Cameron's father was a pioneer of the use of tax havens.
Well, which is, makes it strange that David Cameron sort of kicked off this debate by picking on
Jimmy Carr.
I think some of his own side were not very happy with that, because of course it's opened this question up, but I'm glad the question has been opened up, and I think reasonable people can come to reasonable conclusions about this. I mean, what you've got to recognise is that when the state bailed out the markets a few years ago, there's no if they hadn't bailed out the markets, these people would have lost their money. It's as simple as that. If you're going to have a full-on stock market crash with the banks going down, a lot of these people would be bankrupt. And in actual fact, they'd end up owing money, far more money than many poor people.
Well, you're talking about people like Peter Hargreaves, well, Stephen Lansdowne.
If you're going to go for a free market policy of letting the banks collapse, you've just got to go with it. And you've got to go where it leads. It's a shock and awe strategy. And of course, what it means is a substantial portion of people who made the wrong decisions at the top will lose all of their money, and they will be bankrupted. That is the free market solution. Now, we've not gone for the free market solution because the collateral damage of that free market solution to society would be too great. So the state has stepped in and bailed them out. But that means that the money they're making is not because of their greater skill, knowledge, or merit. It's just because they've managed to game the system. And they've basically blackmailed everybody else, bail us out, or else the whole thing will go down and you don't want that. Now, there's no guarantee that means that they're not actually entitled to the money. And that is the money, that 21 trillion is the money which we need around the world to do what needs to be done in the poor countries and in the wealthy countries. And ultimately, of course, if there is a crash and a big upheaval, these demands will become overwhelming from all sections of the political spectrum, not just from yep. mad lefties like me. Everybody will be saying the same thing, and I think that is probably the way it will play out. Once people realise the depth of the crisis, they're going to get angry and then demand. I mean, don't forget, a lot of these tax havens, apart from Luxembourg, which is protected by the Germans, are protected by the British. We can always send in the Royal Navy like we did in the Falkland Islands, and let's go through the books, eh?
OK, now on to another story. Ex-officer chosen as candidate for Avon and Somerset Police Commissioner. As far as I know, the first of the major parties in the city to choose their candidate. The Liberal Democrats have selected a former police officer as their candidate for Avon and Somerset Police Commissioner. Somerset-born Pete Levy began his career as a cadet and then police constable with Wiltshire Constabulary before spending 6 years in the Royal Military Police and Wiltshire Constabulary before completing several attachments with the Special Investigations Branch. He's since spent 15 years working in international corporate and broadcast production. He's currently a city councillor in Horfield. And he is also on our list of city slackers, because over the last 3 years I've phoned him and emailed him several times, invited him to come on this programme to talk about his views on various topics, go through the week's news. Haven't had a single reply. Haven't even managed to get to speak to him. So very difficult to communicate with. But ultimately, Jeff, I'm not really asking you, obviously, to endorse a Liberal Democrat here, but what are your thoughts in general about the whole concept of moving from this police authority we've got at the moment with lay people on it, with councillors from Somerset, councillors from the city, to one Avon and Somerset police commissioner, an elected commissioner who it looks like will be elected at the end of the year, November?
Yeah, well, first of all, just to add as well, the certainly both Conservative and Labour have selected candidates already.
So
it's the Conservative candidate is Ken Maddock, who was the former leader of Somerset County Council, and the Labour Party selected Bob Ashford, who apparently was a councillor in Frome.
Okay.
So
thank you for correcting me.
So it just proves we read the briefs that you give us. Just, but one of the difficulties with the way that the police have worked in the past is that the committee was made up of councillors from across the whole of Avon and Somerset, but there was very little public identity of those councillors who were serving on the police authority. And so this is designed as part of a process of involving local communities much more in the decision making, by ensuring that there's someone representing the local community who is there in the role of commissioner.
But I mean, this guy is an ex-policeman himself. Don't you think he could be a bit too cosy and too close to the police rather than looking out for the public? I mean, certainly
you can argue both ways. You can argue, and it's the same with the elected mayor. You can argue on the one hand, someone who's involved and knows a lot of what goes on could be bad news because they've got experience and they've got the contacts. You could also argue the opposite, that they are able to know the job and able to do it more effectively. So I think you can argue. I think you can argue both ways. But I think it is very much, I see the police commissioner very much as a role of scrutinising and challenging the direction that the police go. And I think it is important that it's someone who is at arm's length from the police force that they're elected to be commissioner of, so that they can actually have a proper level of engagement but also a proper level of respect. Very important, the role with the chief inspector, the chief constable, because that is going to determine whether the relationship works. And it's got to be someone at a sufficiently senior level to be able to make that relationship work properly.
Well, what's your view on this, Martin? I mean, given that we're having these foisted on us, so we have no choice, we have to have these new police commissioners. Is it a good idea to have someone who's a former policeman themselves, do you think?
Well, I mean, the Liberals obviously think so. I mean, I think the whole thing is extremely dubious. The elected mayor I oppose, but I can see that could be made to work. What worries me about this is that policing is an incredibly sensitive thing, and communities don't in fact have a one view on what the police should or shouldn't be doing, and so you might find the view of inner city residents around here rather different than you'd find in the leafy shires elsewhere. And of course, whoever got elected would only represent one of those views. The beauty of having a committee which has got all sorts of different people on it, even if it hasn't got a high profile, is that the police are getting feedback from all sorts of different communities with different points of view. And if we are going to politicise the police, and we've spent 30 years in Northern Ireland trying to convince people that the police are not political, this is an idea from the United States of America. Perhaps they should have looked over the water to Ireland and see, actually, we're struggling to stop the police being politicised. We're trying to put them above the fray, because it's rather important, especially if you're in a social crisis, that the police are seen to be above the fray. But if we are going to put them into the fray, and the Chief Constable Colin Port will be answerable to this commissioner, whoever it is, I hope it will be Bob Ashford of the Labour Party, I should be lobbying Bob Ashford, as my Green colleagues will be, for a full investigation into what happened in Stokes Croft last April, where three out-of-town riot squads were brought in, lots of local residents, very respectable local residents, were beaten up. Nothing was ever found out about it. Two young lads were sent down for a petrol bomb which the police couldn't find or produce in court. We're very, very unhappy about that, and we're going to politicise the police force because that's what the Conservative government said they wanted, but they won't like it when we get there. They won't like it at all.
Related to this story, of course, is the story we broke on here, what is it, nearly 5 weeks ago now, which is to do with the G4S scandal, to do with the London Olympics. Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week to ask you what you think about G4S. Are you confident that a private security firm will be able to take over from the police, as they've threatened to do in The Guardian 2 months ago? The headlines of The Guardian, and the boss of G4S was saying, "We are going to have a privatised police force and we will be running it in Britain in 5 years' time."
Are there lessons to learn from the G4S Olympic scandal?
Probably. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. They've made one company do all the security. Is this what... And 10,000 people is a lot of people. So I would have thought just have a couple of businesses, like subcontractors, and I think it would have worked better.
I haven't really heard about it, but, I think people are being overly cautious at the minute about the Olympic Games, with all the militarisation and stuff. But I mean, with something as big as the Olympic Games, I guess make sure that stuff doesn't happen.
To be quite honest, I'm not really into the Olympic Games. You couldn't have asked two worse candidates.
Scotland's not into it the same as English ones.
5 years ago there were bombings in London, so I think they have to be safe, the Olympic Games. And if there are poor contracts, that's stupid, because they had made good contracts. Well, that's not typical English. I saw bus drivers checking their buses every time, so they are very safe, I think.
Well, I think when it comes to the Olympics or any type of major event, no expense should be spared. It's about service for the people. At the end of the day, we're providing it, so we want to leave a good impression for the rest of the world as well.
Are you happy with the militarization of the Games?
I think there should be security, definitely. I don't know about the missiles on the top of buildings in southeast London. That's a bit extreme, so I don't think we're being attacked by the sky. If there is any terrorist attack, it'd probably be something more one or two people on the street, sort of maybe homemade bomb, I don't know what, to be fair. But I just think that as long as the police, the numbers are high and the soldiers are high, then yeah, I'm quite happy. But the missiles, I think, are a bit excessive.
Well, it's a shame, really, isn't it? It's supposed to be where the world all comes together and we all competing against each other and everybody's got to be happy. But there are those aspects that need to be addressed. 9/11 was an example of that. Who's to say that something as big as the Olympic Games is now not a target? There's been 4 years for people to potentially plan for the things against that. I don't think it's a good thing, but I think it's a necessary requirement.
It's like in North Korea.
Not really, because it shouldn't be about politics or the military service or anything. It should just be for the people, and I wouldn't find it very friendly or welcoming, you know, seeing officers asking me questions when I, you know, get to any particular games. I don't know if they're going to be the best in customer service or anything like that.
It's pretty intimidating atmosphere to have the army there.
How will Bristol benefit from the Olympic Games?
Oh, Kenya is based in Bristol, so that's probably good money for the economy and good recognition for the UWE, for the university. A lot of people will really benefit from that in the University of West of England. But as a city, I don't know, I think the economy, maybe if the weather's nice, people will come out, people will want to drink in the pubs and watch, so the economy will rise.
Well, I think Bristol, like any other city, or indeed the UK, will benefit because people are going to, regardless of the militarisation, people are still going to be like, wow, it's the Olympics, it's in the UK. So Bristol is in itself, I don't know how that's going to benefit. But
are there games in Bristol? I think not, no.
To tell the honest truth, I don't really know how we're going to benefit from it at all. I don't know, probably when visitors come, they might just pop down to Bristol as well.
I don't know if it will.
It was Marina Morris out on the streets asking you mainly, amongst other things, about the militarisation of London. Now, Jeff Gollop, you're a Conservative councillor. What are your thoughts about this? Because it looked good on paper, didn't it, this contract with G4S? We were getting basically good security on the cheap, 10,000 people for £300 million. But as it's turned out, the army has had to step in at the last minute.
Well, it's disgraceful. I mean, no organisation should commit to a contract and then not deliver.
So whose fault is it? Do you think the Olympic people or G4S? Who's to blame here?
I mean, I don't know that we'll ever find out enough information to be able to assess that. One of my frustrations, whatever level, is people who commit to do something and then don't deliver what they say they'll do. And that's not acceptable, and certainly in terms of any further public sector contracts that are in place, I would have thought there would be questions asked before G4S were included on the list.
Well, because they are in the running to be taking over all sorts of roles of West Midlands Police right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's got to be serious questions because certainly security of this nature and certainly anything to do with the police force, if you take on a commitment, it's got to be delivered 110%, not oh my goodness, we haven't got enough people in place, so we'll delay that particular exercise for another week. Not acceptable. And so I am sure that post the games there will be far more detailed investigation into this and actions taken.
Martin.
Well, I agree with what our undercover reporter was saying a few weeks ago. This is absolutely unacceptable. I think what happens is there's this belief that the private sector can always do things better than the public sector. And I think we need to grow up and recognise that there are good, well-managed public sector organisations and there are badly managed ones, and the same is true of the private sector. And in actual fact, there is no magic bullet, whether it's run by the private or the public sector. It's a question of whether it's properly managed. But cheapskating is always a more expensive way to do it, isn't it? We've actually spent more on it now than we would have done if we'd just put the army and police in charge of it to begin with.
What about the idea of the games being militarised?
Well, that's a wider question about the war on terror and all the rest of it. Those are questions that we cover in this programme quite a lot, but it's a big question.
Okay, well, thanks very much to this week's guests, Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim and Finance Spokesperson for the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council, Jeff Gollop. After the news, well, the Washington Post says the Free Syrian Army is creeping back and forth across the border into Turkey. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News.